we're going to look at here just kind of a quick overview of kind of some of the results we've seen with our near-infrared spectroscopy technology. We'll kind of go through some of the materials and methods fairly fast and hopefully get to the results here soon. Let's see. Press the right button here, Patrick. Is that the
left?
Okay. I'll leave us a little time maybe to talk about where this technology can go in the future, some of the things that we'd like to explore. Just to give a little background, for some of you this will be kind of redundant from what you already know about it, but you know, when you look at dark soil that has high organic matter, light doesn't reflect well off of it. That's because of the fundamental vibrations that absorb the sun's energies, and so you don't see as much light reflecting off of it. So just as our naked eye can pick up, you know, dark and light soil, high and low carbon, so can near-infrared and mid-infrared spectroscopy, but at a lot higher resolution, a lot more precisely what just our naked eye can be trained to see. In the near-infrared, we're looking at overtones. The fundamental vibrations happen out in the mid-infrared region. We're looking at just overtones of those. And as you can see here, the basic bonds are on the previous slide of CH and NH and OH are present here. And you notice the two bonds here at the top, the water peaks there in about the 1450 and 1925, very prominent effects there. When you look at the spectra from our system, you know, those are definitely very evident as well. That's what a set of spectra look like from a field mapped with our system. You know, our objective when we set out, and it's been, gosh, I think my colleague Colin Christie began working on near-infrared in about 2000, maybe 2001, was really to develop user-friendly equipment that people like yourselves could use to collect high-quality near-infrared soils data and relate it to given properties, especially carbon. Obviously, carbon's kind of the one that we're all probably hoping near-infrared can help with. But that was really our objective, was to make equipment that would just work reliable, user-friendly, reliable equipment. To do that and to get quality data, there's really kind of four components. One's just the design of the equipment. And calibration is very important with near-infrared technology. It's important in the lab, and it's even more important when you take the stuff out and start bouncing around the field and getting it exposed to different temperatures and humidities and just different conditions in the field, which, of course, then relates to equipment monitoring, to monitor what's going on with the equipment. And then the final component is taking the reference measurements and doing the calibrations to the lab samples. The equipment itself, we have kind of two models of it. One has been commercialized. This is a close-up of the shank unit. I'll go to, the overall picture and come back. This is what the equipment looks like. It has a shank on it that runs in the soil about 4 to 10 centimeters deep. It's adjustable however deep you want to set it within that range. Runs at a consistent depth. Underneath that shank is a sapphire window. This picture on the lower left-hand corner shows looking up at that light coming through. It has a sapphire window through which we shine a light source and have an optic to receive the reflected light, and it's transmitted then through fiber optic cable out to the spectrometers riding on the equipment. The spectrometers there in the boxes you see up on top. There's also a shank, a probe version of that we've prototyped earlier this year. It's still in product development. It has a sapphire window on the side of the probe. This picture in the lower left-hand corner, you can kind of almost make out the window, but it utilizes the same spectrometer. You know, the spectrometer is obviously the most important or most expensive component on the equipment, so being able to, you know, transfer those over and have measurements that can be correlated with each other, both surface and profile measurements using the same technology, is a good way to leverage the measurements. Probe can also be equipped with a coring probe, so you can take coring samples for further validation. You know, it's really important that this equipment be transferable, so that if we have, you know, 20, 30 units out at different land-grant universities or USDA ARS sources or NRCS, that the measurements can be correlated with each other. Of course, some of that assumes that they're all run on a similar LECO or dry combustion system, so the lab measurements, the calibration measurements are similar. But our equipment needs to be, the measurements themselves need to be standardized. So we standardize everything when it leaves the factory to a set of grayscales, so that they're all, you know, standardized back to a master instrument. Then in the field, before each field is mapped, each file is created, there's a set of external references put on the shank. That's the right-hand graphic shows that little block behind it. There's four avian grayscale reflectance standards that are put on the bottom of that shank, and a transform is created with those. And those deal with instrument variation kind of over time, and just make sure that as you map that field, it has the same transferable data from, you know, the master instrument back at the factory. Then while you're mapping, there's a set of Darken reference measurements that are taken every 10 minutes. And let's see if I can get this pointer to work. Yeah, it loses a little bit of its power at length.
Here, use the mouse. I think that's
this mouse?
Yeah, put it down. And that's another room.
Okay. Well, let's go to another room.
There you go.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. Man, you're right, man. Okay, so as you go through the field, here's the normal operating position. You see the light source illuminating the soil being reflected back into the optic. Every 10 minutes, and it doesn't happen automatically, it happens on the next time you raise the machine and turn around, so it doesn't surprise the middle of the field. There's a reference shutter that slides over, and the back of that reference shutter is a known reflectance standard, and so what is reflected off, I'm sorry, it closes, the dark closes off the light, so you get a dark measurement, so you can account for any noise that shows up there. And then the next step is it closes partway, and the reference material on the back of that shutter is reflected back onto the into the optic. So you get a dark and a reference. And that deals with just any drift you have in light source or in the spectrometer itself as you're going through the field. So that set of transforms and calibration standards is a great way to make sure your data is repeatable from one time to the next. Here's what the equipment looks like. We use a Windows XP operating system. We've written software to allow you to collect the data. 20 spectra a second, 386 measurements, and 8 nanometer resolution. So it's a lot of data. It's a pretty large data set when you're done. Here's a screenshot of what the operating system looks like. You know, shows the different monitors, temperature of the cases, humidity of the cases. It's all designed as basically if you got a green light down at the lower left hand corner that says log, everything's go. So we try to make it user friendly in that sense. The software that we sell with the system takes you through data acquisition. It does not take you through the calibration side. I mean, there's programs like PLS Toolbox and those that are out there to take your lab samples and calibrate to the spectrum. But our system takes the data. It then does a reduction of the data using principal component analysis. It allows you to select sample points based on the number of clusters you want to look at. And then it'll actually guide you to the sample points. And when you hit enter, it logs that point, allows you then to interpolate the spectra around that sample point. So when you're done, you've got a file that's got the interpolated spectra at those sample points ready to calibrate with your laboratory sample for your property of interest. Just some results here. We've done a lot of work with carbon. These are three different studies we did with the spectral data underneath calibration lab samples. We typically map fields on 20 meter transects. Of course, that's what anybody wants to do, they can do. But these fields are all mapped on approximately 20 meter transects at about 8 kilometers an hour. We kind of look at numbers on those four fields. Some of you may have been over to the presentation that Dean Hively made on the Maryland data. They got a lot better numbers than we got. I think they got above 0.7 R squared, so we prefer to use their numbers. So, you know, little different calibration techniques. And I think we're just at the beginning of researching just how to do these calibrations and how to leverage this information in such a way that we can improve that prediction. But there they are, good RPDs on three of the four fields.
What is RPD?
It's the relative percent difference. It's the standard deviation divided by the RMSE. So it's how much improvement you made over the RMSE. Just looking at on the bar graphs and some other properties we're looking at. Obviously, total organic carbon. Kind of what we do best, and this really matches kind of what's been printed in the literature about an infrared spectroscopy. It pretty well is verified there. Good with total carbon, total nitrogen. Real good with CEC. Spotty with pH. Not so good with P and K. I was in Maryland where we had some of those fields had been manured and sludged. So, you know, we may have been picking up some of that rather than, and maybe that's why we did a poor job on carbon. Could have been some interference there the way we were looking at it. But if we look at it on a leave one field out, these other validations have all been leave one out validations. This is the red or brown, whatever color bar that is a leave one field out. Just this is one state set of data for carbon. I'm sorry, for all the properties. And you can see with six fields to predict, five fields to predict the field that we left out, we're starting to develop enough of a data set to be able to really do a pretty good job on predicting the carbon and some of the other properties without ever setting foot on that field to take soil samples. And a slide that shows the results of kind of multi-field calibrations where we're starting to build that spectral database like Keith Shepard and others have done, and starting to improve some of our calibrations, some not so good. We haven't done a lot of validation work outside of Kansas with the probe, but we did a pretty extensive six-field study this summer where we used the probe. These are the results, again, RPDs and R-squareds in the six different fields. We'll talk about that first, then I'll move to bulk density. Other than this first field of Drummond, where we had a fairly low R-squared and low RPD below 2, we did pretty well. The RMSE was pretty low, really, on all the fields. Pretty good results there on with the probe. The thing that we're encouraged about is the bulk density. You know, for measuring carbon for a carbon sequestration program, you have to really know carbon, not just the carbon percentage, but the actual carbon with the bulk density factored in. With near-infrared, you know, we're getting a measurement of moisture. Relating to moisture, we're getting a measurement of carbon, we're getting a measurement of texture. We're getting we have an EC tip on this probe, so we're getting another kind of surrogate measurement for texture. We also have a force sensor on it, so we're getting the surrogate parameters that should help us get a handle on bulk density. And while some of those numbers aren't as good as we'd like, there's some promise there that we can do some good bulk density measurements with the probe. How am I doing on time, Patrick?
Probably
need to wrap it up. Okay. Just a slide showing real close transects. Some of these in the middle were taken about 2 feet apart, so you can kind of see that pattern of what's happening with the soil profile. You can see the kind of the spatial structure of it. The thing I wanted to get to, if I have time, is, you know, there's legislation in the Senate right now for cap and trade legislation that would allow agriculture to be paid for carbon. And in order to do that, we really have to be able to measure it in order to sell it to the people who want to buy offsets. I mean, we can measure it in research and it's interesting, but if you're really going to pay somebody to measure, it's going to have to count. The Nicholas Institute at Duke University has developed a standard. It was just published this summer, and part of our project was to try to use that standard with sampling with sensors to reduce the confidence interval that standard calls for. And this is the fields we did. We were able to pull that confidence interval down from 0.91 to 0.51 by stratifying the fields ahead of time using the sensors, which results in an increase in measurable C. One more slide. One of the fields we did had been in no-till for about 9 years, and half the field had been in conventional till, same soil types. We were real careful to keep the sampling unbiased. Encouraging thing was we did pick up the kind of the expected difference in carbon. This is a 0 to 15 centimeter measurement. We did see the stratification, 0 to 5, you know, more carbon in the no-till there, less in the, you know, but overall in the 0 to 15, we did pick up, you know, a significant increase in carbon with the lab measurement. The encouraging thing was, if you look at the sensor measurements for the field, we also picked it up with the sensor measurements as well. If we can use sensor measurements with the confidence interval, and we have several hundred sensor measurements per field, that really helps us get that confidence interval down very, very low. So that's kind of for future work. We just throw that out there. Okay, conclusions. You can go collect near infrared data. It's easy to do. It shows good potential to improve a number of things we're trying to do up the field. And probably is equal important, good opportunities for research. Patrick?
Okay, thank you very much.